I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And in this episode, I'm going to look at the trauma of the Second World War for France, the politics of liberation, the very violent politics of liberation, and the beginnings of anti-fascism in France during the period of purification, which was the arrest and trial of prominent French fascists and the removal of fascism from French public life. There's an interesting story here in how fascism perpetuated itself in France. The fact that there's the possibility, a very distinct possibility, of an openly fascist party, Le Front National, coming to power, founded by a former French SS officer, is a kind of a testament to that fact. Okay, so tonight we're looking at Fascism, a History by Roger Eatwell. And Roger Eatwell begins with the kind of the reckoning that was brought about at the end of the Second World War. He writes, "As the Allied armies drove through France after D-Day, a bloody and bitter settling of accounts followed in their wake, as the resistance wreaked retribution. The small fry, like the women who'd practiced, in inverted commas, horizontal collaboration, were usually roughed up and socially humiliated and ostracised. Others paid more dearly for their errors. Françoise Armagnac, who lived in Exudil, was taken by a marauding group of the resistance as she left her wedding in the summer of 1944. She was led out to a large house nearby, where the wedding breakfast awaited. There, members of the resistance found a diary which showed that she had briefly been in the Milice, the Vichy French fascist militia. She was shot, still wearing her wedding dress, in the garden of the house at sunset the next day. Probably at least 10,000 people were killed during the process of purification, and over 100,000 were arrested." Previously, I've looked at Keith Lowe's Savage Continent, where he said roughly a similar story. In Italy, up until 1946, the anti-fascist partisans who had been mercilessly arrested, tortured, and executed, particularly in Mussolini's Social Republic set up in 1944, were able to have a long period of bloodletting, of arresting and sometimes kidnapping in extrajudicial actions fascist mayors and administrators and police chiefs, and particularly all across central and northern Italy, there was a kind of a low-level guerrilla war fought up until about 1946, mainly with the fascists on the receiving end. So Roger Eatwell writes, there was much rough justice in post-liberation France. Communists especially paid off old scores in those areas controlled by the major communist wing of the resistance. Partly as a result, the story of the purge could vary notably from area to area. In Pérenne, for instance, where the local chief of the resistance received orders from the regional purification committee to arrest various local supporters of the Vichy government, he tore up the telegram. Some local communities were able to demonstrate remarkable powers of collective amnesia. At times, this was because local bonding was particularly close, but the more perceptive local leaders also looked to the future. They realised that with liberation would come the need to forge a new national consensus which would remove the stain of Vichy. Of course, the thing that isn't mentioned here is the shadow of the Holocaust. Vichy France is enormously complicit in the Holocaust, and there were considerable numbers of French soldiers, Vichy soldiers, police officers, administrators, bureaucrats, train drivers, housing officials, who operated not directly under the thumb of Germany, because the Vichy France was self-administered, but in alliance with Germany and in compliance with the German final solution, and with a no small level of enthusiasm. If you look at Pierre Laval, the Prime Minister of Vichy, and his the orders that he gave for deportations, and the coordination between Vichy France and the SS for the removal of Jews from Vichy territory, and the removal of Jews from occupied France, German-occupied France, all the way through Vichy into Germany. It was an astounding level of complicity. And this was something that many French people wish to consign to the kind of the historical, the collective historical amnesia, and you find a similar process in many other European countries. Tony Judd, the essay that he wrote at the end of his amazing book Post-War, From the Houses of the Dead, essentially on the Holocaust and modern European memory, basically says that Europe is built on the ashes of Auschwitz, modern Europe. And what he meant was that every country is in Europe has a degree of complicity and an enormous conspiracy of silence, making the point rather ably that it wasn't the SS, it wasn't German soldiers that arrested Anne Frank, it was Dutch police officers. And such things were replicated throughout Europe. Anyway, an important part, writes Roger Eatwell, of this process of removing the stain of Vichy was the series of trials which began in late 1944. Thousands of people were arraigned before the courts, and many others would have been had they not gone into hiding. The two main defendants were Marshal Pétain and Pierre Laval. The 89-year-old Marshal was duly sentenced to death, though this was later commuted to life imprisonment. He died in 1951. Laval did not have age in a First World War record to protect him, and after a travesty of a trial, he was executed in 1945. Among the other leading figures executed was Joseph Danand. Now, as an aside here, Joseph Danand was the head of the milice, or the militia. He was a French Waffen-SS officer who became, in 1943, head of the police, and then later on the Secretary of the Interior. The milice had 35,000 members in 1944 and were engaged in anti-resistance operations, but by mid-1944 had become essentially kind of like an armed gang, and had very little kind of central kind of discipline and control. Carried out assassinations of suspected resistance members, roundups of those who were either thought to be in the resistance or kind of avoiding military service, and obviously the arrest and deportation of Jews. Roger Rootwell writes, Dunand, whose murderous collaborationist activities offered no hope of a defence, was also executed. Several key intellectuals, too, were targets of post-liberation wrath, reflecting the importance accorded to intellectuals in French life. Robert Brasillach was executed in 1945 after another mockery of a trial, despite a petition for clemency signed by numerous intellectuals who did not sympathise with his views. Drieu La Rochelle committed suicide after penning a defence in which he seemed to welcome death, perhaps realising that fascism needed to die to be born again, and that he was a microcosm of this process, a martyr to the cause. The ageing Charles Maurras, who was condemned to life imprisonment, his pre-1940 writings had undoubtedly condemned him in the eyes of many. Now, regular listeners will know that when I've discussed pre-war or interwar French fascism before, Charles Maurras' name has come up as a kind of a leading figure in interwar, the development of interwar fascism, and a great admirer of Hitler. His pre-1940 writings had condemned him, but he had sealed his fate by approving of the milice and the brutal suppression of terrorists. So essentially, he had come out for the murder of resistance members. And the resistance in after 1944 become essentially part of almost like a civic religion in France. Everyone wishes to say that they were in the resistance, though very few people were. And the resistance, even though many of their activities were quite murky, were beyond reproach. They were the spirit of France and the nation. On hearing his verdict, he cried, "This is the revenge of Dreyfus," obviously referring to the Dreyfus case of the 1880s and the anti-Semitic persecution of a French army officer at the end of the 19th century. The revenge of the left and of the French people, keen to place most of the blame on a few dangerous teachers and politicians, would perhaps be a more accurate epitaph, writes Roger Rootwell. So, this is how anti-fascism becomes a key part of France's national identity, despite the fact that France's the popularity of fascist ideas in France before 1940 is significant. And, of course, anti-Semitic attitudes, when judged against the rest of Europe, were highly prevalent in France. They had been highly prevalent since the beginnings of the 20th century, and the late 19th century, as the Dreyfus case points out. So a powerful reactionary fascist tradition in France was prevalent. But the trauma of the Second World War, of the humiliation of occupation, and the need to expel the national enemy, meant that there were deep roots for anti-fascism to take hold in France.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Anti-fascism, writes Roger Eatwell, also provided the basis of the government headed by General de Gaulle, who had triumphantly returned to Paris in August 1944 at the head of the Free French Forces. De Gaulle's desire to portray himself as standing above politics meant that he resisted the temptation to form his own party. Instead, he formed an administration comprised mainly of the groups and parties which he cooperated uneasily in the closing stages of the resistance, namely the communists, though elements in the party advocated a coup, the socialists, and the new Christian Democratic style party called the Popular Republican Movement. The first 2 years of post-war French political life and the beginnings of the Fourth Republic were very complex and confusing. One of the first tasks was to form a government that would rule effectively and that would be able to function in the new conditions that France found itself in. However, de Gaulle resigned in January 1946, announcing basically that the party leaders were showing that they were exactly as most people imagined, unable to cooperate, squabbling and making petty kind of sectional demands in the interests of their voters. The new constitution of the Fourth Republic, writes Roger Eatwell, narrowly endorsed by a referendum in late 1946, did nothing to prevent these fears. It adopted a list system of proportional representation which guaranteed that several major parties would gain representation. However, more importantly, it provided for only a figurehead president and accorded considerable powers to Parliament rather than the executive. As such, it seemed a perfect recipe for a rapid return to the old ways of the Third Republic. The Third Republic, by the 1930s, was a politically divided, kind of febrile polity, based on clashes between the right and the left, as the kind of the rise and the fall of the Popular Front showed, and the fact that polarising forces of socialism and fascism across Europe were beginning to tear it apart. Tony Judd's argument, and I think it's a compelling one as to the rapidity of the fall of France, was that France was politically close to collapse even before Hitler's tanks crossed through the Ardennes forest. De Gaulle saw it this way. De Gaulle thought that there was the possibility of a weaker, divided France. And in 1947, he formed the Rally of the French People Party, or the Gaullist Party, which was something that seemed to have fascistic elements externally. It was anti-communist. It relied upon a charismatic leader, de Gaulle, and his powerful war record. It was something that was based in the mobilisation of the people with mass rallies and this sort of thing. It may have had certain fascistic characteristics. Whether it can be encompassed in what we understand as fascism is probably doubtful. The left certainly labelled it as fascist. Roger Reitwell writes, the fact that some neo-fascist parties, most notably the Italian social movement, showed an interest in Gaullism illustrates that there were some interesting parallels, although the RPF was clearly not truly fascist in terms of its social radicalism. The RPF did have fairly progressive social policies, and you know the difference between something like that and Nazism, where there was a kind of a vague gesture towards redistributive politics. The reality in Nazi Germany is that redistributive politics were for Aryan Germans exclusively, and the extent to which anything was redistributed in Nazi Germany is far, far less than really apologists for Nazism would make out. Most of the time, working class people that did that saw improving standards of living, with or without things like kind of the KDF. Managed to obtain that through overtime and munitions work in the late 1930s. And living standards still managed to slide because the use of the munitions industry acted like a sponge, sucking resources out of the rest of society. Anyway, that's a kind of a digression there. So the RPF had appeal. French people didn't see it as fascist. They didn't see it as being anything like a continuation of Vichy in any way. It was represented by de Gaulle. There was no way that you could accuse de Gaulle of being fascistic. But de Gaulle was a person who many French people hoped would restore the pride and the honour of France. He has certainly been highly combative during the war towards the British and the Americans. To kind of bêtes noires in the eyes of many French people, and he was equally suspicious of a mistrusting of the Soviet Union and Stalin. And what de Gaulle sought to do and would seek to do over the next two decades would be to pursue a French trajectory through the Cold War with an immense scepticism towards towards NATO, a kind of an independent nuclear policy, and a kind of a robust interest in fighting to hold on to the kind of the Francophone world and the French Empire, both of which really kind of fizzle out in the 50s and 60s. The party, writes Roger Reitwell, began to attract support rapidly, and in the 1951 elections, it became the largest party in the National Assembly. But it was well short of an overall majority, and de Gaulle soon slipped back into retirement, leaving the RPF a divided but troublesome opposition group within the Chamber of Deputies. Because the third largest party, the Communists, had retreated into Cold War isolation during 1947, governments had to be constructed from the remaining parties, who were bitterly divided over many issues. The result was the continuation of the old pattern of ministerial turnover, and between 1951 and 1956 elections, France was governed by 11 ministries. Parallels with the Third Republic were heightened by the fact that the whiff of corruption and scandal was again in the air. While mainstream political life was reviving, former fascists and leading supporters of the Vichy government were initially forced to live a more precarious existence. But enthusiasm for the purge died quickly after 1945. It served its purpose. Besides, by 1947 and the onset of the Cold War, had turned the spotlight onto the communists as the new enemy. One sign of the times was the re-emergence in 1947 of the Action Française periodical Aspects de France, edited by Javier Vallée, who was a former commissioner of Jewish affairs in the Vichy government. So it's really interesting, and you see many parallels of this in Cold War Austria and Cold War Italy, of the kind of the political untouchables, the traitors of the fascist ghosts of the Second World War, slowly eking back into prominence during the Cold War, able to expunge any crimes they committed or brush this under the carpet, and emerge with robust anti-communist credentials. They accept a couple of aspects of democratic life, which maybe they find slightly irksome and distasteful, and hopefully one day they'll be able to get rid of. But by and large, they were able to secure their legal status and often their financial status by making a case for the anti-communist struggle. And CIA officers across Europe often warmed to these characters, perhaps being unaware of their past or willfully ignorant of it, and thought that they could be highly useful in either propagandistic struggles in places like Italy and France, or actual operations into the Warsaw Pact, where the vast majority of them died. There's a really interesting, in Tim Viner's book, Legacy of Ashes, a really interesting chapter about how the CIA would congregate around certain bombed-out German cities where people from places like Belarus and the Baltic states, emigres there at the end of the Second World War, or Hungary and other Warsaw Pact countries, would spend their days in cafes and bars and would be recruited by the CIA for basically suicide missions. By the early 1950s, a variety of other journals and groups had been formed, such as the Jeune Nation, which was set up by Pierre Sideuse, whose father had been executed at the end of the war for being a leading member of the Milice. Jeune Nation adopted as its symbol the Celtic cross, a symbol previously carried by the French Waffen-SS Charlemagne division. Although these groups and journals had small members, they actively kept alive non-conformist traditions and sought new supporters. So as we saw when we looked at the history of post-war Italian fascism, in the initial years after the Second World War, after the defeat, after the destruction of collaborationist governments, the trick by French and Italian fascists was to just keep the tradition of fascist thought in France and Italy going, and then eventually there would be opportunities to expand and grow as a political force later on. Anyway, thanks very much, and I hope you enjoyed listening. Do pop by the Explaining History website. What I'm trying to do at the moment is, when I post a new podcast, write a little bit more contextual knowledge about it. So check out the blog. If you are able to support us on Patreon, that's always very, 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 very valuable. And it's kind of how the Explaining History podcast keeps going. And I'm very, very grateful for all the people who already support the podcast. There's a little bit of new content going up onto YouTube at the moment, so do remember to subscribe there. And thanks very much for listening. All the best. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.